From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I have a beard that makes me resemble Moses, or Abe Lincoln, or Ted Kaczynski. I've been called all three.
You have to be really committed to facial hair to grow a beard like A.J. Jacobs. Jacobs doesn't even really like his, but then he didn't grow it for himself.
My quest has been this: to follow the Bible as literally as possible, without picking and choosing.
The things people will do for faith: growing a beard of biblical proportions, or devoting 5 years of your life to the Maharishi.
I wanted enlightenment. I wanted cosmic consciousness. TM was really the only game in town. If you wanted meditation instruction, you went to Maharishi.
Or how about going on pilgrimage and walking 8,000 miles barefoot across the continent of India? When he was only 9 years old, Satish Kumar joined the Wandering Brotherhood of Jain Monks in his native India. At 18, he became a campaigner for land reform and one of Gandhi's followers. To protest the nuclear arms race, he made an 8,000-mile peace pilgrimage, walking from India to America without any money. Years later, he did it again, celebrating his 50th birthday by walking 2,000 miles with no money around Great Britain. Now, in his 70s, Satish Kumar is one of the world's leading voices in bringing together spirituality and ecology. He's the editor of Resurgence magazine and the founder of Schumacher College in England. Steve Paulson sat down with Kumar recently and asked how his spiritual values have informed his life.
When you were 9 years old, you joined the Wandering Brotherhood of Jain Monks, and I know you stayed a monk until you were 18. What did those years of living the monk's life teach you about nature?
When I was a monk, I meditated upon nature. I will go out in nature and stand under a tree, because I will remember that even the Buddha learned from the tree. He was enlightened while sitting under a tree. Because when you are standing under a tree, or sitting under a tree, you can see how all life is connected. The rain is falling and nourishing the tree roots. The birds are coming and sitting on the tree. The seeds are falling and giving fruit and food and nourishment to the worms. Worms are making the land fertile and nourishing the tree. So how the cycle of life and the connectivity of life, how it is all together, how the interrelationship of all living beings act, I will learn by standing and meditating under a tree.
Now, I wonder if there was something specific about Jainism, about this religious order that you had joined, that led you to some of these insights.
The specific quality of Jain religion is adherence and its belief in nonviolence. Nonviolence is the greatest religion for Jains. There is no other religion greater than nonviolence. So as a Jain, I will not even wear shoes, because if you are wearing shoes, then you might tread on some creatures on the earth and they might get hurt, whereas the feet are soft. And even if I am walking bare feet, I will look down watching the earth so that I don't tread on any creatures. And if at night I'm walking, then I will have a little brush in my hand and I'll sweep the floor before I put my foot down. So this way, Jains practice nonviolence to its extreme level. And that's what I learned. And so nonviolence to nature, my ecology, nonviolent ecology, came from Jain ecology.
Let me ask you more about walking, because you've spent years walking. I mean, you went on pilgrimages at various points in your life where you would walk across an entire continent. It sounds like you're saying that walking can have real spiritual significance.
Absolutely. But when you are walking, you are touching the earth. And you are touching the earth, you feel a sense of belonging to the earth. And earth is holding you. Earth is sustaining you, and walking becomes a spiritual practice. This is why all great teachers, religious teachers, have gone on pilgrimages, because walking is the best form of meditation and best form of relationship with the natural world, with the earth, with the trees, with the air, with the sunshine, with the whole existence. And so walking is a beautiful and a very high form of spiritual practice.
I'm surprised that you didn't say it also forces you to slow down. You can't go too fast.
Spirituality and speed don't go together. The very fact that you are walking, you have to go slowly. And you have to believe that when God made time, He made plenty of it. There is no shortage of time. You don't have to get somewhere quickly. Getting somewhere is not as important as how you get there. So the process of living, the process of walking is more important. This is why I called my autobiography No Destination. Because when you are obsessed with reaching somewhere, you take any means of travel. But when journey itself becomes important, then you realize that not only this walking where you are going somewhere, the life itself is a journey.
Well, I have to ask you about this because you're not a monk anymore. You live in England. You edit a magazine. You teach at a college. You give talks around the world. It sounds like it could be very demanding. I'm wondering how much you can incorporate these principles of slowness and walking and not venturing too far off, how much that you can incorporate into your own life.
All those things I do slowly. And I get up in the morning and I spend an hour reading spiritual scripts. I spend at least half an hour, 40 minutes doing yoga and meditation every day. And then I, at least half an hour, I have a siesta after lunch. So whatever work I am doing, editing a magazine or lecturing or whatever other work I'm doing, I never hurry. I say there's plenty of time. The quality of your work is more important than the speed of your work and the quantity of your work. So I always shift my consciousness from quantity to quality.
Do you end up saying no a lot? I mean, when people ask you to do things?
Yes, to some extent I have to say no, because if somebody's asking me to go to a conference and I'm already doing something else in my diary, then I will have to say no. But I try to say yes as much as I can, because I like to honor people's requests and people's invitation. So I do it with a very light sort of foot. I don't feel any kind of stress or strain when I do something. I do slowly and I do with love and with care. And that way I can live simple and slow life.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how you manage to do this when I can't and so many other people can't. I mean, for me, it seems to be this test to see if I can fit everything that I seem to need to do into a day.
No, I do only one thing at a time. And when I'm doing that thing, I'm doing only that thing at that time. I'm not doing anything. I'm not thinking about anything else that I have to do too much, other things. I will do what I'm doing fully, totally present in that moment. And when I finish doing that, then whatever next comes, I will do that fully and totally at that moment. So I live in the moment, in the here and now. Every moment is a very beautiful moment. And my full concentration, full attention, full mindfulness is there. And that way, I don't feel any stress. I don't think that I have to do too much. I have a day, whole day. Time is always coming. I have plenty of time to come and plenty of time to do things. And if I don't accomplish everything in this life, there's a next life.
So are you really saying that you don't have any stress in your life?
No stress.
No stress at all?
No stress at all. Because if you are living in the moment, in the here and now, and everything you do is a work of spiritual practice and a work of art, then there is no stress. And you are painting a picture, you can't feel stress because this is what you want to do. If you are writing a piece of poem, you can't feel stress because this is what you want to do. So I do only what I want to do. And when I do it with imagination, with mindfulness, with slowness, and with creativity, with imagination, and with full presence, with mindfulness, and then there's no stress. Stress is because we are worried. Am I going to achieve? I'm not trying to achieve anything. There's nothing to achieve. Action in itself is its own reward.
But doesn't stress also come from just trying to do certain things, to take responsibility? You know, maybe you have a job for most of the day. You have children and you have all kinds of responsibilities there. I'm just trying to think of how some of what you're talking about applies to the typical American lifestyle.
No, I do things without doing them. I'm not the doer. Things are happening through me, but I am not the doer. I don't take any burden of the action. Action is naturally flowing through me. So, like children come through you, not from you, Khalil Gibran said. In the same way, actions come through you. Words come through you. I'm speaking to you now. These words are coming through me. I'm not taking any kind of ownership or possession or worry, or I'm not in any stress. I'm not in any hurry. I'm just speaking in a nice, relaxed way. So this way, I do every action, and there is no need to have any stress. I'm not interested in any outcome. I'm not interested in any achievement. I'm not trying to get somewhere. I'm not trying to succeed in my life. My life is not about success. My life is about self-realization and fulfillment. And if we seek fulfillment, we will have no stress. If we seek success, we will have stress.
As you look around the world right now, you are an activist. You campaign for the principles of simplicity. You're shaking your head. You don't do that?
I am, okay. But not in a kind of missionary way. I'm not trying to preach anything. And I'm not saying that people must listen to me and follow me and they must change as I want them to change. Like you plant a seed. And planting the seed is your action. After that, seed will grow by itself. And your work is to water the seed, maybe. So what I am doing in my mission, and it's not really a mission, but in my work, when I'm trying to promote simplicity, sustainability, nonviolence, peace, all these things are like watering the seed. The tree will grow by itself. The seed knows how to become a tree. I don't have to tell people to be peaceful. People know how to be peaceful. I'm only there to encourage them, to remind them to water the seeds of peace in their heart. That's all I'm doing. And if the peace does not grow, then too bad. I'm not taking any responsibility. So you can say I'm very irresponsible in that way. But I don't want to take the burden of the world on my shoulders. I'm not God. I'm not shaping the whole world. It's not my responsibility to change the whole world. I'm here not to change the world, but to serve the world. When you want to change the world, you take a burden of changing and responsibility of changing. And that can be stressful. When you are serving the world, you do your best and that's it.
Satish Kumar talking with Steve Paulson. Kumar was one of Gandhi's followers. Now in his 70s, he's the editor of Resurgence magazine, which has been called the spiritual voice of the Green Movement, and founder of Schumacher College in England. And Jim Fleming, it's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. When it comes to turning your life around for your beliefs, well, some of us have to start a little smaller. Some of us first have to figure out what we believe. Journalist A.J. Jacobs decided to do something pretty radical for him. He grew a beard. And then he kind of kept going.
As I write this, I have a beard that makes me resemble Moses, or Abe Lincoln, or Ted Kaczynski. I've been called all three. It's not a well-manicured, socially acceptable beard. It's an untamed mass that creeps up toward my eyeballs and drapes below my neckline. I've never allowed my facial hair to grow before, and it's been an odd and enlightening experience. I've been inducted into a secret fraternity of bearded guys. We nod at each other as we pass on the street, giving a knowing quarter smile. Strangers have come up to me and petted my beard like it's a Labrador retriever puppy or a pregnant woman's stomach. I've suffered for my beard. It's been caught in jacket zippers and been tugged on by my surprisingly strong 2-year-old son. I've spent a lot of time answering questions at airport security. I've been asked if I'm named Smith and sell cough drops with my brother. ZZ Top is mentioned at least 3 times a week. Passersby have shouted, "Yo, Gandalf." Someone called me Steven Seagal, which I found curious since he doesn't have a beard. I've battled itch and heat. I spent a week's salary on balms, powders, ointments, and conditioners. My beard has been a temporary home to cappuccino foam and lentil soup, and it's upset people. Thus far, 2 little girls have burst into tears, and 1 boy has hidden behind his mother. But I mean no harm. The facial hair is simply the most noticeable physical manifestation of a spiritual journey I began a year ago. My quest has been this: to live the ultimate biblical life, or more precisely, to follow the Bible as literally as possible, to obey the 10 commandments, to be fruitful and multiply, to love my neighbor, to tithe my income, but also to abide by the often neglected rules, to avoid wearing clothes of mixed fibers, to stone adulterers, and naturally to leave the edges of my beard unshaven. Leviticus chapter 19:27. I am trying to obey the entire Bible without picking and choosing.
So what exactly do you have to do if you decide to follow the Bible as literally as possible? Well, you begin as A.J. Jacobs did, by buying a Bible, or 2, or 3.
I bought a literal stack of Bibles, all different kinds, Jewish, Christian. Someone sent me a hip-hop Bible. It said, "The Lord is all that," instead of the more traditional, "The Lord is my shepherd." I read them all, and I tried to assemble a list of all of the rules and advice in the Bible.
How did you decide what was a rule that you had to follow?
Well, my plan was to follow everything without picking and choosing and see what applied to me, what made my life better, what enhanced my life, and what was maybe not so relevant. So that was almost the mission. And of course, some were easier to follow than others. There was a lot of rules that were very difficult to follow.
Everybody knows the 10 Commandments.
Right.
That seems like a pretty safe place to start, right?
Right. And following the 10 Commandments alone, you know, could have taken me a year, could have taken me a lifetime. No lying. That one was a killer. I was disturbed to learn just how much I lied in everyday life. And I don't consider myself much of a liar, but just the number of white lies. And even as a father raising my child, you know, "Sorry, the TV's broken. We can't watch TV. The toy store is closed. We can't buy a toy." It makes parenting so much easier. So I decided to try to not fall back on that. And it was fascinating, but also incredibly challenging.
Those are ones that everybody knows. What about
right.
the others, the ones that you found that – did some of them surprise you?
Well, they surprised me in many ways. I mean, they surprised me in how bizarre they seemed in the beginning, and yet they also surprised me in how some of them became meaningful to me, even the bizarre ones.
Well, give me an example.
Well, there are plenty of bizarre rules. There's the whole you're not allowed to wear clothes made of mixed fibers. So in the beginning, I got rid of all of my poly cotton T-shirts because I thought that was what I had to do. Then I actually talked to some Orthodox Jews who told me, actually, it is wool and linen. Those are the two that are forbidden. So that's the ones I got rid of.
Why would they do that?
Well, it's one of those that they say, we don't know the answer. We don't know why this is in the Bible. But that's beside the point. You have to follow it. It almost shows a deeper commitment of faith if you follow these irrational ones. And I think there's an interesting point there, that maybe there's something to following traditions. I mean, all rituals, if you think about it, are irrational. You know, blowing out candles on a birthday cake, that's not rational. You know, if a Martian came down and saw people blowing fire on a cake once a year, they'd be like, what's going on?
There are others that get to issues where you have to be concerned. Stoning adulterers, for instance, is one that is mentioned, I know, several times. And I know you had to find a way to allow yourself to do that, but that...
That was difficult, yeah. I'll tell you first how I decided to fulfill it. And it happened later in the year. I was dressed in my biblical garb because by the end I looked like quite a biblical character because I had this huge beard because I can't shave. So it had this ZZ Top-like beard. I had my white robes. I had my sandals and I was in the park. And this man came up to me, an elderly man actually, and he said, "Why you dress so weird?" I explained my project. He said, "Well, I'm an adulterer. Are you going to stone me?" And I said, "Well, that would be great." I took out a handful of pebbles. That was the way I figured, because in the Bible, it doesn't say the size of the stones. I took out some pebbles, and he was quite confrontational. He grabbed the pebbles from my hand and threw them in my face. So I felt in self-defense I could throw one back at him. So that, was how I followed it. But it also, it had a deeper meaning in the book because it allowed me to talk about this fascinating issue. How can the Bible be so wise and compassionate in some areas and yet so seemingly barbaric in others?
What was the toughest of the laws that you had to follow?
Well, certainly there was the stoning type, but more there was the radical ethical makeover that I had to undergo, this idea of no coveting and no lying and no gossiping. You know, I live in New York City and I work in the media, so that's, 70% of our day. So
gossiping and coveting and lying?
Right. But I loved doing it. And one of the fascinating things I learned was that when you behave a certain way, your thoughts almost follow your behavior. It's almost like deed dictates creed in a way. So I started acting like a good person. And I eventually became a little bit of a better person. You know, I'm not a saint. I'm not Angelina Jolie. But I am. I stopped gossiping. So I started to have less negative thoughts about people with which to gossip.
I can see how some of these things might make your life quieter, gentler. But there are others that I would think that would generate some problems. There are rules, for instance, about the relationships with your family. This must have changed your relationship with your wife.
Well, absolutely. I mean, as you say, some things and a lot of things that I've carried with me after the year and has changed my life for the better have enhanced me, like the Sabbath. You know, I'm a workaholic, always checking my emails, even in the brushing my teeth, checking my emails. Here was a rule that said you cannot work one day a week. You must rest, reflect, spend it with the family. I mean, this is a wonderful rule, whether you're an agnostic, an atheist, or a deeply religious person. I think it should be across the board. But then there are others that were deeply difficult. For instance, as you say, in my relationship, there's all the laws against touching women during certain times of the month. And my wife, I didn't touch her. And even more, there's a rule that says you cannot sit on a seat where a woman from that time of month has sat. And my wife really did not like this law at all. She thought it was sexist. So she sat in every chair in our apartment during her time. And
I was sorry,
forced to
I shouldn't
stand.
Laugh. So no, you ended up standing for those times a month.
I did a lot of standing. Yeah, it's true. And I respected her ingenuity, of course.
And your relationship with your son, was it improved or made more difficult by this?
I think it made more difficult and improved. It did make me a bit of a better father, I hope. Maybe that's breaking the biblical laws of humility. But I will say that I am a pushover dad, or I was. I would let my son get away with anything. But the Bible says you have to balance the mercy with the justice, the compassion with the justice. So you have to, you have to impose some discipline and structure because that's what God did with his children, us. Like you look at the Garden of Eden, that's what he did with Adam and Eve. And if I were in charge of the Garden of Eden, I would have, given Adam and Eve a warning and then a second warning, So this taught me that I had to have a little discipline. Now, that said, there are passages in the Bible that say you should hit your child with a rod. In the Proverbs, do not spare the rod or you'll spoil the child. Now, there are people who take this literally. There are people who will sell biblical rods to discipline your child. And I think this is a terrible misinterpretation. I think if you take the Bible literally, then too literally, you're doing a disservice to it, and you're going to be doing things that I think harm your child, like hitting them with a rod.
What do you think, looking back, was the most memorable experience you had during your year?
Well, it is hard to choose because I really feel like I packed so many highs and lows into this year. One of the things that does stand out is this ritual I went to with some ultra-Orthodox Jews that happens once a year. It's called Simchat Torah. And it happened in Brooklyn, and they're basically thousands of black-hatted Orthodox Jewish men, and they were in a huge room the size of a gymnasium, dancing and singing in the most joyous manner I have ever seen. Oh, by the way, they were also incredibly drunk, because that's part of the ritual. But it was almost like a mosh pit or an Orthodox rave. It was an epiphany for me because as a secular person, I focus a lot on the negative parts of religion, the guilt and the sin and the long prayers. And I feel like I gave short shrift to the fact that religion can be a portal to joy and it can really provide you with some of these moments.
You said you felt that this had made you a better father. Has it changed you in other ways? Do you feel like a better husband, better friend, better employee, better employer?
I hope so. I don't know. I now am trying to carry that through and still be thankful for the 100 little things that go right in a day instead of focusing on the 3 or 4 that go wrong.
A.J. Jacobs is the editor-at-large of Esquire magazine, and he's the author most recently of The Year of Living Biblically.
Narayanam Padma Bhavam Vashishtam Shaktim Chatat Putra Parasharam Cha.
I was 18, and I saw a poster advertising a free public lecture in Transcendental Meditation, and I went, I did the course, and I loved it, and I've been meditating ever since.
Jeff Gilpin was one of the hundreds of thousands of young people who got caught up in the Transcendental Meditation movement in the early 1970s. Its charismatic guru, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, made meditation practically a household word. Gilpin not only joined the movement, he went the whole nine yards, including spending 5 years as a student at Maharishi International University in Fairfield, Iowa. Recently, he went back, packed his car, and took off for Iowa to find out what became of the movement that once meant so much to him. In his new book, The Maharishi Effect, he describes what he found. And Strange Champs asked Jeff Gilpin why he fell in love with TM in the first place.
What was the very first time you tried meditation like?
Well, the lecture itself wasn't all that impressive to me personally. Maharishi at the time was emphasizing very practical things, health benefits like reduced rate of heart attacks and high blood pressure and so forth. And I was 18, and those sort of things really didn't appeal to me. I wanted enlightenment. I wanted cosmic consciousness. But back then, TM was really the only game in town. If you wanted meditation instruction, you went to Maharishi. But I remember the morning that I learned, and I had this experience of wonderful inner clarity and peace. And I remember coming outside and looking up and seeing the clouds and the blue sky so clear as if I'd never seen them before. And it was just wonderful.
Hmm. Once you learned the basic technique of meditation, what was it that pulled you even further into the movement? What was so attractive about it at the time?
Well, for one thing, it was such a great social scene. Many groups go through a process of evolution where in the early days, it's all new, it's all fun, it's like a big party. You're part of a family, you have an identity. You have a mission to transform the world, and it's just great. And, of course, that was very tied up with the atmosphere back in the 60s and 70s. You know, a lot of people in the TM movement came out of the counterculture. And we maybe realized that revolution wasn't going to occur through street demonstrations or through LSD. And we realized that there was hope for something else, a revolution in consciousness.
As you spent time in the Maharishi's movement, did you become enlightened? Did your consciousness continue to evolve?
Certainly. Maharishi has an analogy that I really like. He says that before you start meditating, it's like you're looking through a very narrow angle lens at, say, a mountain range. You see a little bit of a peak here and a few trees here and there. But as you meditate, you broaden your lens. You zoom out where you see the whole mountain range. He also says that you feel more at home. You feel more like yourself. There were a number of other aspects to the TM movement that I wasn't comfortable with.
For instance,
the conformity. A lot of people in the movement adopt a sort of in-speak that's part Sanskrit, part New Age language. And over the years, I saw that becoming, I think, more rigid. I saw the movement becoming more authoritarian, more hierarchical, and I really wasn't comfortable with that. Mm. So when the time for me came to move on, I just got on with my life and said goodbye, and that was it.
At its higher reaches, people who were close to the Maharishi and people who'd been practicing TM for a while began to make claims that seemed somewhat incredible, claims that if you kept on, you could eventually learn to levitate, for instance, yogic flying.
Yeah. Well, that was something that was just beginning to appear in the world of the TM movement about the time that I left. I think what happened is that people in the movement had been meditating for a long time. Maharishi said that you would become enlightened, you would attain cosmic consciousness in 5 to 8 years. And in the late 70s, a lot of people had been doing it for 5 to 8 years, and a lot of people were wondering, well,
okay,
what happens next? My guess is that Maharishi was under a certain amount of pressure to come up with something to keep the crowds happy. And in the late 70s, he came up with new meditation techniques, which are technically known as the siddhis or yogic powers. And the most famous one is yogic flying. Supposedly, if you learn this technique, you can lift off and levitate and fly like Superman. I was there on the campus of Maharishi University in the late 70s when the first group of yogic flyers came back from Maharishi's headquarters in Switzerland at the time. And they were doing the flying technique in my dorm in a lounge that they had closed off. They put sheets over the windows and they had guards at the door to keep everybody out because this was top secret. And I heard them doing something down there. And I snuck down the stairs and I peeked in. And it was a bunch of guys sitting in the lotus position on foam mats, bouncing up and down on their rear ends and yelling their heads off. And it wasn't very dignified, and they certainly weren't flying. To me, it was just more evidence that the movement was moving in a direction that I really wasn't interested in.
Hmm. Now, you, as you said, moved on, got on with your life, stayed a serious meditator. That's been part of your life for a long time.
Definitely.
What made you, though, decide to turn around, go back, and take a closer look at what had happened to the Maharishi's movement?
Well, it was one particular event. It was in 1999, I got a mailing from the movement, a flyer with a very scary warning on it. The headline on this brochure was Maharishi's Final Warning to the United States. And he said that the only hope is if the governments of the world turn to Maharishi and implement his programs. And to me, the tone of this brochure was alarming. Back in my day, Maharishi was always very kind of jovial. You know, his nickname was the Giggling Guru. He was always very positive and laughing and telling jokes. And now suddenly here he is warning about the end of the world, like some apocalyptic street corner preacher. And frankly, I had visions of another Jonestown. I was really worried that something was going on in the movement that would lead to a bad end, and I wanted to find out for myself.
What are the main changes that you discovered?
The movement itself is now not the grassroots organization it was in my day. It is, frankly, a theocracy. Maharishi, a few years ago, crowned one of his followers as a god king, who is supposedly the king of us all, the sovereign of the whole world. And everyone in the movement now is a subject of Maharishi and his god king. There's a court of rajas, of Maharishi's followers, who administer basically all of the world. In Wisconsin, there is a Raja, I believe in Chicago. We're part of his dominion. The I know.
Even those of us who don't recognize his authority or know he exists, we're still part of his dominion?
You weren't aware that you're part of a global theocracy run by Maharishi. That's a huge change. And if something like that had been going on in my day, I would have just turned and run in the opposite direction. So that's a huge change. Another thing is, I think, that the emphasis on fundraising, whatever spiritual element there is in the movement, whatever meditation, whatever else there is, has, I think, become secondary to fundraising. For instance, the rajas. If you want to be a raja, you take a raja training course, and the price for this ranges between $500,000 and $1,000,000.
But you mean you can basically buy rajahood? It's not simply conferred on you because of your advanced spiritual powers?
Well, as I see it, the size of your bank account in the TM movement is also an indication of your spiritual development.
What about the Maharishi himself? Mm-hmm. Were you able to find out anything about him? And how did he go from being this jovial, giggling guru to somebody who warns about the end of the world?
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating story. And it's really a difficult story to say because he's been a recluse now for many, many years. He lives in a compound in the Netherlands surrounded by a small staff, by his king and his rajas, basically, who, I assume, tell him what he wants to hear.
He must be a very old man by now.
He's very, very old. He's in his 90s. He does occasionally appear on the Maharishi Channel, his satellite TV network. He gets up and talks, and apparently he's had any number of health problems over the years. But, you know, for a guy in his mid-90s, I think he seems like he's doing okay.
Are there any particular lessons you've taken away from the investigation you did mm-hmm. of the movement and what had happened to it? You know, as you take that wide-angle, long view of the movement, what conclusions have you come to?
My motto is keep your crap detector turned up on high. If you join a group, if you become interested in a guru, if you want to follow a particular teaching, the spiritual journey can be a very valuable, enriching thing. It is very, very easy to fall into gullibility and superstition. And I think especially in a case where we assume that a leader is more than human, to me that's just fraught with peril. And if you see an organization where the leader is referred to as God or appears to have some kind of divine authority, that's I think, a real red flag. It's true that on the spiritual path, you are, by definition, embracing irrationality. Irrationality is part of the human mind, part of the human psyche. We can't get rid of it. It's there. So is critical reason. So is rationality. So is skepticism. If you abandon those things just because you're on a spiritual path, you are giving up a good part of what it means to be a human being.
Well said. What role does TM still play in your life today?
Well, I still do it. I still meditate twice a day, morning and evening, for 20 minutes, and it cost me $35 to learn how to do that back in 1973, and I think I got my money's worth.
See, are you one of them?
Jeff Gilpin tells the story of his years in the TM movement in a book called The Maharishi Effect. Anne Strangechamp spoke with him. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We're talking about faith in this hour and the things people will do for it. Doesn't have to be faith in God or some transcendent reality. Could be faith in our human ability to transform the future, to fight injustice, to make our voices heard. Alex Olson is a well-known progressive artist activist, a leader in the slam poetry movement. Ms. Magazine calls her a road poet on a mission. She's also been dubbed a spoken word diva and a word warrior.
I was still sucking my thumb the first time I sang We Shall Overcome. It was a numb December night, a small town fable. My first corporate villain and my mother was the hero. And I was clutching the back of my mother's kneecap. I squinted up at her fist. I asked her, why are we so mad? And she parked her head down in the freezing rain, and she saw me, so serious and small with my big Mack truck union sign. She smiled to herself, pondered the politics of fingers curled. This is solidarity, she whispered to her baby girl. And she smelled right then like the coal mines of the industrial age. She was perfumed in truth, and she reeked of risks taken, because the time to strike is when the iron is hot, Martin said. All truth crushed to earth will rise again, like the words of the women before me. June Jordan, Barbara Smith, Sonia Sanchez, Adrian Rich, Flannery O'Connor, Ruth Ellis, Bell Hooks, Flo Kennedy, Gertrude Stein, Dorothy Allison, Angela Davis, Mary Daly, Kay Gardner, my mother, my grandmother, and all of the other women before me.
Alex Olson is upfront about all things. Her sexual orientation, she's gay. Her politics, progressive. And her faith, atheist. Steve Paulson sat down with her recently to talk about her work.
Now, I want to take you back a little bit in your own history of doing this kind of poetry. You write in the introduction to your book, Word Warriors, that getting involved in the slam poetry scene in New York City some years back was probably the most influential episode in your life. Mm. Why was that so important to you?
Well, I think that I've always been a highly political person. I've always sort of seen the world through a political gaze. But I think I was pretty angry about a lot of things and didn't really have an outlet or a medium for that. And I was doing theater when I was in college, but it was, you know, I always played the sort of ingenue parts. And then I was also writing political poetry. But the amalgamation, the way that the performance and the writing and the theater all came together was just a really perfect artistic medium and outlet for me, and I think allowed me to be actually a much more buoyant and kind and compassionate person because I wasn't absorbing all of the anger that I had about the world and political dynamics. I was actually able to express myself, and I think that's why spoken word is so powerful, because it really, it's a pretty simple form.
So there's something about getting up on the stage, talking into a microphone before a raucous audience. I mean, somehow that brings some essential part of you out.
Absolutely. And connecting with people. Even if an audience and a performer are laughing together, that is a really powerful moment. Even if it's about something that we're angry about, you know, that we're able to collectively make light of something, or, you know, it's a relief. It's a connective relief.
There's so much going on in the kinds of poems you do. I mean, you know, you're obviously playing with language. There's a literary quality of this. There's also a pretty strong political message in a lot of your poems.
Mm-hmm.
Do you draw a line between the art and the politics?
No, I never have. They've always really been interconnected for me. I really can't see one without the other. I mean, I think that all poems are political. It's just how much they choose to really engage a specific vantage point. But if you ignore, you know, if you ignore the world around you, that's also political in its own way. It's sort of buying into the mainstream and not connecting directly with politics.
You wrote about an experience that you once had in Portugal when you were at an international poetry festival, and you got accused of being too angry, too confrontational by some of the men there. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. Yeah, I was flown to the Faladora Poetry Festival. It was the first time they had slam poets. It was really a traditional sort of, you know, traditional genre poems. And I was one of the only women that was flown over, and I was also one of the few slam poets. And they really had no idea what I did. And so they put up this big screen behind me with all of my poems translated into 10 different languages. And, of course, I accessed some words that are not FCC approved, but one can use one's imagination. And so they had to put up big stars in all the spots where I accessed those words. And afterwards, I was taken out by the male poets, and they were not happy about how angry some of my work was, and they said that they did not have sexism in their country, and therefore they were not able to understand my feminist anger. And they also said that they thought I should calm down, that my particular brand of poetry was too unruly to be called poetry, that it was really more like theater, and perhaps I should think about entering politics or becoming an actor, and I should really calm down and be more subtle. If I wanted to be a poet, I needed to be more subtle. So I ended up writing a poem called Subtle Sister, which I think is decidedly not so subtle.
Right. Well, and I'd love to have you perform that, but we can't, given the FCC rules and the language that you use. But tell me a little bit about what you get into in that poem.
Well, I tried to get into the ways that sexism is pervasive globally, and I think the undercurrent is that subtlety is not always is sometimes a luxury, and sometimes we cannot be subtle because the world and sexism is not subtle. And sometimes we need to match that with a different set of tools, namely directly calling it for what it is.
Now, you are also very upfront about your own sexuality. What role has spoken word played in queer politics?
For example, I was on HBO doing a deaf poetry jam. I heard from a lot of young girls and young women after they were able to see that. It's interesting because spoken word is such a grassroots genre, and here it was, you know, making millions of dollars for a network. But on the upside, it really gave broader access to spoken word and to queer politics in ways that, you know, young girls in the middle of Iowa or Utah might not be able to find our work, you know, in their independent bookstore, if they had an independent bookstore.
So you're saying slam poetry can really change lives?
I know it can. I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen thousands of times with myself, with my colleagues, my peers, my allies. Yeah, we're really lucky we get that enforcement. We get to hear back from people about it.
Could you tell me about one of these experiences where something that you wrote really changed someone or affected someone else profoundly that you heard about then?
Oh, my gosh. There are just so many lonely, young, queer people out there that I hear from. I mean, the most dramatic. I heard one young person wrote to me, it was a trans person, a transgendered person, and said that he or she was thinking about committing suicide and sat in the car and listened to a poem that a friend and I had co-written together about transgender politics and said that she put the gun down, and that was pretty amazing. I think people feel very alienated and very alone, and it doesn't take much. It just takes being honest and authentic, I think, in your work to connect with people.
It must be amazing to hear a story like that. I mean, someone actually holding a gun while they're listening to you.
Yeah, I know that sounds really, really dramatic, but it really did. It was very powerful for me, yeah.
Now, as you say, you've been doing this for a while now, for a number of years. Has your style changed over this period?
I think it has, yeah. I think that, you know, I always, when I was in my early 20s, when I started doing this, I always would get so angry when I would hear these, what I thought of as curmudgeon-y, you know, older people saying that they were a little more relaxed about their anger. They weren't so angsty and feisty. And unfortunately, or fortunately, that definitely, I never thought it would happen to me. But yeah, I always hated the phrase, you know, shades of gray, because everything seemed so black and white. And it still does to me. I think I have a very political binary in terms of what I think of as good and bad and right and wrong. But my own position within that framework, I think, has relaxed a little and changed a little bit with, you know, other stuff happening in your life and needing to incorporate lots of other outside experiences and nuanced perspectives.
Ugh.
But that's I never thought that would happen.
Well, that's fascinating to hear you say that, though. I mean, that maybe that just comes with age. Maybe it comes with getting a little burned out with sort of just the more straightforward confrontational style.
Yeah, I think so, you know. And people would always say to me, I'm passing you the torch, you know, I'm passing you the torch. You're the new, you know, generation, and here you go. And I feel a little tired. I'm ready to pass on the torch. It's heavy. it's a heavy thing.
You mentioned that you're an atheist. So obviously you have rejected religion in any conventional sense. But I'm wondering if you see your work as being spiritual in any way.
I do. I have a new poem I just wrote called Clash, which is actually about that. It's about coming into my own understanding of spirituality, having rejected all of the preconceived notions of it. I sort of, again, always had this icky feeling about people saying, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. It called up all kinds of, I don't know, odd rituals or something. But yeah, I have a line now that says, you know, for once I'm mistaking a commercial plane for a star and the moon is abruptly small under my thumb when I squint and I'm thinking, oh my God, what if things are relative? I think I'm in awe. I think my spirituality would just basically be awe of existence and of humanity and of natural altruism. And I'm really inspired by people. I know I don't think that the world is God's creation. I think it's something that we can't really understand. And so I sit in awe of the world, and I'm inspired by people, not a higher power.
Slam poet and progressive activist Alex Olson talking with Steve Paulson.
My mother taught me to tangle with the big boys, to pull out my thumb and make friends with my voice. That's my mass weapon of choice. So in this Hallmark hub of a century, with its sugar cookie cutter white boy fame, see, I will not be afraid of being called the same. No, you cannot be afraid of being called the same names as the women before you. June Jordan, Barbara Smith, Sonia Sanchez, Adrienne Rich, Flannery O'Connor, Ruth Ellis, Bell Hooks, Flo Kennedy, Gertrude Stein, Dorothy Allison, Angela Davis, Mary Daly, Kay Gardner, my mother, my grandmother, and all of the other women before me. The women before me. The women before me. You see, I take my legacy. I take my legacy. I take my legacy seriously.
For more of Alex Olson's poems, look for her documentary Left Lane, On the Road with Alex Olson, her CDs, Built Like That and Independence Meal, or the new anthology Word Warriors, 35 Women Leaders in the Spoken Word Revolution. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like to purchase a copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for Walking the Walk, number 1230A. You can also stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strainchamps and our technical director, Kirill Owen, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. We always like to know what you think of our programs. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We look forward to hearing from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.